an emergency, the hospital would page the doctor and they'd drive over to deliver the baby or slice up the appendix. Emergency device for emergency situations. Then suddenly everyone had pagers. Then everyone had cell phones. Now everyone is accessible, anyway, anytime. Do you remember when stores used to be closed on Sundays? It was family day, church day, quiet day. Nothing was open. You couldn't get anything done. Neither could anyone else. Then a few stores started opening on Sundays. Others wanted to compete. Local laws changed. Online stores opened 24 hours a day. How do you add an hour to your day with only one small change? You need to remove access. Close the doors, lock the windows, but answer the bell. The only two modes your brain actually has, and how to use them. John Cleese, co-founder of Monty Python, knows a few things about removing access. Freeing your brain from the tyranny of busy. He is famous for removing access and creating space in his life. What was the effect? Oh, not much. Just scoring Golden Globe and Academy Award nominations and being in more than 100 movies all the way into his 70s. As John described it in a speech to the organization Video Arts, we are in closed mode most of the time when we're at work. He says, we have inside us a feeling that there's lots to be done and we have to get on with it if we're going to get through it all. It's an active, probably slightly anxious mode, although the anxiety can be exciting and pleasurable. It's a mode in which we're very purposeful, and it's a mode in which we can get very stressed and even a bit manic. What's the opposite of this? John calls it open mode. That's where your brain is free and playful and capable of achieving greatness. Sounds slightly counterintuitive? Maybe. But by closing off access to your brain, you're opening up your mind. By contrast, John continues, the open mode is a relaxed, expansive, less purposeful mode, which are probably more contemplative, more inclined to humor, and consequently, more playful. It's a mood in which curiosity for its own sake can operate, because we're not under pressure to get a specific thing done quickly. We can play, and that is what allows our natural creativity to surface. How do you get yourself into open mode? How do you block access? Let's take space, John continues. You can't become playful and therefore creative if you're under your usual pressures, because to cope with them, you've got to be in the closed mode, right? So you have to create some space for yourself away from those demands, and that means sealing yourself off. You must make a quiet space for yourself where you will be undisturbed. You must make a quiet space for yourself where you will be undisturbed. One of the hardest and most important things you will ever do at work. How do you actually eliminate other outside disturbances? How do you cut off access to yourself without building a shack in the middle of the forest? It's not easy. While working as director of leadership development at Walmart, I counted 6 distinct ways people could communicate with me. Email, voicemail, instant message, texting, written notes, and walking up to me at my desk. Every interruption took time because I suddenly had to do 3 things. 1, bookmark. 2, prioritize. 3, switch. Psychologist David Meyer of the University of Michigan says, people in a work setting who are banging away on word processors at the same time they have to answer phones and talk to their coworkers or bosses, they're doing switches all the time. Not being able to concentrate for, say, tens of minutes at a time may mean it's costing a company as much as 20-40% in terms of potential efficiency lost, or the time cost of switching, as these researchers call it. In effect, he continues, you've got writer's block briefly as you go from one task to another. You've got to A, want to switch tasks. You've got to B, make the switch. And then you've got to C, get warmed back up on what you were doing. René Marois, a psychologist at Vanderbilt University, has done a study showing the brain exhibits a response selection bottleneck. I like that. When someone calls me at the same time as an email comes in and a person walks up to my desk, what happens? Response selection bottleneck. Picture saying that in a robot voice. Error. Response selection bottleneck. In other words, I get jammed up. Another study from Harvard Business School is called Rainmakers, Why Bad Weather Means Good Productivity by Joa Julia Lee, Francesca Gino, and Bradley R. Statz. They show that bad weather reduces our options of what we can do and increases our productivity. Less access to outside, more work done inside. One day at work, I decided to block off as much access to myself as possible. Close the doors, lock the windows, but answer the bell. For me, the bell is emails from my boss. First, I logged into my voicemail and permanently set it to vacation mode, where it didn't allow callers to leave a voicemail. There was no beep. There would be no red light on my machine. I just left a message asking people to email me instead, and then spelled out my email address really slowly a couple of times. Next, I deleted our office instant messaging software and deleted my profile in the texting application we all used on our work phones. Coworkers used these to send messages because they came with the illusion of parallelism, but it was a red herring. Bookmark, prioritize, switch. No, I would never be in away mode anymore. I flat out deleted it. Last, I disabled all notifications from my email. No dings, no pop-ups, no reminders telling me an email arrived. With no voicemail, no text messages, no instant messages, and no email reminders, what happened? I created focus. And if I needed space from my own desk, I could go work in the cafeteria. By cutting off access to myself, I was able to choose what to focus on, aim my brain at that task, and then nail it. How do you add an hour to your day with only one small change? Remove access. Close the doors, lock the windows, and pick the bell you will answer and focus on. Delete and remove all access to yourself except for one. Watch as your productivity spikes, your days become more productive, and you create beautiful space. Chapter 7. What is this life if, full of care, we have no time to stand and stare? Why are we so busy? Because we've run out of space, and we don't always value space enough in our lives. What's the secret step we can take to never be busy again? Create space. Build it in. Make sure you always have it. Space in your day, space in your week, space in your month. Allowing ideas to percolate, relationships to bake, and years to fully blossom into long and happy lives. Creating space is the secret step to freeing yourself from the oppression of your busy life. Let's remember the three ways to create space. The three removals. Remember the dark-caped crusaders with menacing masks holding big sharp scythes? They hack at parts of your life so you're free to do other things. Space comes from this hacking. Space in your life comes from hacking at choice, time, and access. Number 1. How to make every decision at twice the speed. Remove choice. Number 2. What's the counterintuitive way to having more time? Remove time. And 3. How to add an hour to the day with only one small change? Remove access. What do we get by creating space? Tim Kreider wrote The Busy Trap in the New York Times, where he says, "Idleness is not just a vacation, an indulgence, or a vice. It is as indispensable to the brain as vitamin D is to the body, and deprived of it, we suffer a mental affliction as disfiguring as rickets. The space and quiet that idleness provides is a necessary condition for standing back from life and seeing it whole, for making unexpected connections and waiting for the wild summer lightning strikes of inspiration. It is, paradoxically, necessary to getting any work done." Maybe it sounds conflicting. On one hand, we're talking about never retiring. On the other, we're talking about creating space to get more done. But let's remember that retiring means stopping completely. Creating space means injecting space into your life so you can properly live it. Thoughts process, experiences reflect, and ideas spark. And burn is even sweeter after that. Remember the space scribble. Flip between burn and space. Take thinking breaks. Take doing breaks. Use the three removals to add to your life, because life is short, time is fleeting, and you will never be as young as you are right now. So develop extra space by removing choice, removing time, and removing access, and nurture that space, that powerful space, so it fills your mind and time and life with contentment, freedom, and happiness. I want this for you more than anything. The poem called Leisure, written by W.H. Davis in 1911, is all about creating space. We have to go back over 100 years to find the perfect poem talking about how to live a happier life today. Let me read it to you now. What is this life if full of care, we have no time to stand and stare? No time to stand beneath the boughs and stare as long as sheep or cows. No time to see when woods we pass where squirrels hide their nuts in grass. No time to see in broad daylight streams full of stars like skies at night. No time to turn at beauty's glance and watch her feet, how they can dance. No time to wait till her mouth can enrich that smile her eyes began. A poor life this, if full of care, we have no time to stand and stare. And that's the end of section number 2. Do anything. We talked about 3 secrets. Secret number 4, never retire. Secret number 5, overvalue you. And secret number 6, create space. Now we begin section 3 of the book, have everything. Carl Jung said, "The privilege of a lifetime is to become who you truly are." It's been said that John Lennon said, "When I was 5 years old, my mother always told me that happiness was the key to life. When I went to school, they asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. I wrote down, happy. They told me I didn't understand the assignment. I told them they didn't understand life." And Marcus Tullius Cicero said, "Nobody can give you wiser advice than yourself." Secret number 7, how to turn your biggest fear into your biggest success. Chapter 1, the childhood trauma that made me quit swimming.
"Don't be a wimp! Get down here! Get on the slide!"
Wet bathing suit clinging to my sides, I was sitting on top of the curving blue plastic slide, staring down at the bright baby blue pool and the open arms of the gigantic burly man with a thick black mustache. He taught with my dad, and we were at the annual end-of-year school party at the principal's house. Teachers were mingling on the patio near the barbecue, and everyone was celebrating the start of summer.
"I'll catch you! Don't be a wimp!"
I was 8 years old and couldn't swim, but had been playing in the shallow end with my sister Nina all afternoon, watching kids climb to the top of the slide and squeal as they slid down feet first, hands first, face first. Sprinkler water sparkled at the top from a garden hose and slick greased the slide in the scorching sun. It looked inviting, conquerable, easy. I had finally decided to climb my way up and give it a shot. My 6-year-old sister swam like a fish, and my parents were doggy paddle pros. I was the family anchor.
"I'll catch you. Don't be a wimp."
Looking down at the bright baby blue pool below, I stared into the eyes of the high school math teacher who worked with my dad. Then I took a deep breath and pushed off. Wind blew into my face, my stomach lurched, and I watched with excitement and then sudden fear as the burly teacher's waiting arm suddenly lifted up into the air as he laughed. He wasn't going to catch me. I plunged into the deep end and my vision cut to bright blue horror film footage. My chest was filling with water, and I tried to breathe, frantically flailing, hot suffocating pain like I was being smothered by fiery blankets. My eyes lost focus and I was flailing and flailing and flailing until I finally felt big hands grab under my armpits and lift me out.
"See, you can swim," he screamed. Barbecue smoke, beer bottles, distant laughing. My sister running for my parents, coughing up water. It felt like glass in my chest.
Chapter 2, 2 barriers we place in front of anything we don't want to do. I stopped swimming that day. Ear infections dotted my childhood, so I was outfitted with a never-ending set of tubes.
Swimming lessons became skating lessons when I got fancy rubber-molded earplugs and a plastic cap for showering. On summer vacations, I would dip into the pool, in the shallow end, or occasionally strap on a life jacket and goggles, clinging onto whatever floating styrofoam I could find, kicking my way around for a few minutes. At teenage pool parties, I didn't bring my bathing suit and made up excuses while sitting on the deck. When friends at college went swimming at the gym, I went for a jog on the treadmill instead. I was afraid of swimming, and I became good at avoiding it. Why didn't I swim? Well, first, I didn't think I could swim. I took a few lessons after the tubes were out. Picture a scared 14-year-old who didn't want to get his face wet, in a baby pool of 5-year-olds picking neon golf balls from the bottom of the pool like circus seals. I quit as soon as I could. I still also have that memory of my dad's pool party. I couldn't breathe. I didn't float, and falling into deep water reminded me of pain. So first, I didn't think I could swim, but second, I didn't want to swim. Who cares if I could? I wasn't motivated. What was the big deal? Strapping on a bathing suit meant showing off my spaghetti arms and man boobs. It meant getting cold and wet and chloriney, and showering and changing afterward. For what reason? Exercise could be done in other ways. As I got older, I told myself the best conversations were at the barbecue or beer cooler. I didn't live near an ocean, so I convinced myself swimming was a waste of time. What are the two barriers we place in front of our least desirable tasks? Can't do it, and don't want to anyway. Chapter 3. The Secret Scribble to Moving from Fear to Success. Let's take a step back. Swimming was my fear, sure, but my brain was giving me all the same signs we all experience. In order to do something, we need to think we can do it first, and then we need to want to do it second. Then what happens? We do it. We tell ourselves that this is how we get anything done. It looks something like this. Can do, then want to do, then do. For me, when it came to swimming, I couldn't get past can do. I can't swim. Or want to do. I don't want to swim. So I never got to do. I'm going swimming. I learned the secret to getting those tough things done a few years ago. Everything changed in a flash when I fell in love with Leslie over a few months. A few dates in, and she started telling me over dinner one night how much she loved to swim. "It's my favorite thing to do in the whole world," she said. "The water just feels like home to me." "Not me," I said, a bit disappointed. "I don't swim. Not a big fan." "Well," she continued, "you'll have to be if you want to come to my cottage. It's on an island in the middle of a lake. We all swim around the island every morning. My 10-year-old cousins, my 80-year-old grandparents, all of us. You don't have to join, but you'll be the only person sitting on the dock." I signed up for swimming lessons that night. Suddenly, without thinking whether I could do it, but whether I wanted to do it, I just did it. I just went online with my credit card and signed up for an adult learn to swim class offered by the city at a downtown pool. A few weeks later, I was nervously stripping down on a lacquered pine bench in a moldy locker room for my first swimming lesson in 20 years. My heart was thumping. My hands were sweating. I felt like putting my clothes back on and leaving. But somehow, I walked out into the pool area and learned one of the most valuable things of my life. What happened? Within 2 minutes, I realized I fit in. Who was with me? Recent immigrants from landlocked countries, those with more traumatic childhood experiences than mine, and people from families that didn't have money for swimming lessons when they were kids. I wasn't the worst swimmer in the group for once. We all sucked. Trust formed quickly. Within an hour, I was flutter-kicking in the deep end, wearing a life jacket. Within a couple weeks, I was jumping in. A month later, I was treading water, and by the end of the classes, I was doing the front crawl. I looked like a drowning deer, but my fear was melting. How did it happen? This is the secret. This is the big thing I realized. This is the secret you can apply to get anything done that you don't want to do. I promise you it will work. After my first swimming lesson, the idea that I might be able to swim crept into my head. I thought, I could do this. And the thrill of flutter kicking in the deep end gave me inspiration to go back next week and see what else I could do. I wanted to swim now, I love moldy locker rooms. Give me the flutterboard. I was desperate to get back.
That do line I explained earlier changed to a do circle.
What's the difference?
Well, picture that diagram I explained earlier, going from can do to want to do. Now picture it turning into an endless loop. Can do leads to want to do, which leads back to can do, which leads back to want to do. It's endless. There is no start or finish. It keeps going and going and going. You don't have to end at do. Do can be a starting point. Do leads to can do.
Let me explain. What happened in the pool?
Well, I just did it. So I believed I could do it. So I wanted to do it.
Instead of finishing at do, I started there. And that made me think I can do it. And that made me want to do it. Everything happens backward.
Once you start doing, confidence and motivation follow.
I did it. I went to the pool. I got changed. I wore a life jacket. I flutter kicked. So I believed I could do it. This was it. I was in the pool. I wasn't drowning. So I wanted to do it. I wanted to swim. I wanted to keep going. I'm a swimmer.
The do circle completely reverses how most of us operate every day.
We all do this. How do we operate?
Well, first we think we can do it. Then we want to do it. Then we do it.
We think we must have the ability to do something, and then the motivation to do it before we can successfully do it. Otherwise, we fail. The risk of looking stupid sits in front of us and gives us fear. It's the way I thought about swimming for years.
What's wrong with that thinking?
Well, it keeps undesirable tasks undesirable by placing our ability to get them done way down the mine tunnel at the end of the rickety railways of self-confidence and inspiration.
What happens? Our most desirable tasks are placed way off in the distance with mental barriers dropped in front of them.
Want to write a book?
Oh, I'll take a writing course to learn how. Then I'll find a perfect coffee shop to get inspired. Then I'll write a masterpiece.
Want to write a book? Just write one page, even if it sucks. The fact that you did it will convince you that you can do it. Then you'll want to do it.
Why? Because we love doing things that confirm our belief that we're able to do them.
Want to start exercising?
I'll save up for a trainer or a gym membership and a set of new shoes. Then I'll make the perfect playlist and find a gym buddy. Then I'll become a gym rat.
Want to start exercising? Run out your door. Just run. It doesn't matter what you're wearing. It doesn't matter how far you go. You could run for 2 minutes to the end of your street and back. The fact that you did it will convince you that you can do it. Then you'll want to do it. Then you'll be a confident and motivated person who buys some running shoes for next time.
So what big lesson did I learn that day? I learned it's not easier said than done. It's easier done than said.
Chapter 4. How does Jerry Seinfeld use this secret to write comedy?
Jerry Seinfeld is one of the most successful comedians in the world. He has Emmys and Golden Globes, and Fortune magazine estimates he earns $32 million a year from Seinfeld syndication rights alone. A successfully touring stand-up comic, a New York Times best-selling author, he owns almost 50 Porsches. At one point, he was the highest-earning celebrity of the year. But in spite of all these accomplishments, Jerry still needs ways to trick his brain into getting stuff done, just like you and me. According to an interview Brad Isaac did with Lifehacker, Brad was a little-known stand-up comic touring the New York City comedy scene in the early 1990s when he bumped into Seinfeld backstage at a show. The TV show Seinfeld was new and hadn't become a massive hit yet, so Jerry was touring clubs throughout the city. After his set, Brad saw Jerry backstage and saw a big opportunity to ask him if he had any advice for younger comics. Jerry Seinfeld then revealed to him a way he writes comedy to make it his favorite task every day. Brad recounts that Jerry said, "The way to be a better comic was to create better jokes, and the way to create better jokes is to write every day." Brad goes on to say, "Jerry revealed a unique calendar system he uses to pressure himself to write.
He told me to get a big wall calendar that has a whole year on one page and hang it on a prominent wall. The next step was to get a big red magic marker. He said for each day that I do my task of writing, I get to put a big red X over that day. Well, guess what that does? It tricks his brain by giving him the incentive to see the longer and longer chain. Who wouldn't like seeing big red X's marking accomplishments on a wall? Now all you have to do is keep the streak going. Does this sound familiar? Jerry Seinfeld gets his work done by doing it first. That creates the confidence of being able to do it, and then the motivation to grow the chain and want to do it each day. Chapter 5. A 30-second technique to using the secret in your daily life. How can you start by doing in order to get more done? Here is an anecdote shared by Ramit Sethi, author of the New York Times bestseller, I Will Teach You to Be Rich. I was having problems getting myself motivated to go to the gym. Every morning I'd groggily wake up and say, ugh, I know I should get up, and then roll over and go back to sleep. Day after day, even though I genuinely wanted to go to the gym. I finally realized that motivation alone has very little to do with successfully changing behaviors. I started testing different techniques, adding gym to my calendar, sleeping 30 minutes earlier. I would test different approaches for 2 weeks, and I got mediocre results. But when I sat down to analyze why I wasn't going to the gym, I realized my closet was in the other room. That meant I had to walk out in the cold in my boxer shorts to the other room, shivering while I put on my clothes. Easier to just stay in bed. Once I realized this, I folded my clothes and shoes the night before. When I woke up the next morning, I would roll over and see my gym clothes sitting on the floor. In fact, I couldn't get up without stepping on them. The result? My gym attendance soared by over 300%. Many people have reported similar results from the gym clothes effect. Some even sleep in their gym clothes, so they're even closer to doing when they wake up. After all, they've already put their clothes on, might as well go to the gym. My clothes are already on. It would take more work to change into something else. Spend 30 seconds putting yourself in a situation where it's easier to do. This is me signing up for swimming lessons. Now, if I skipped my first lesson, I would have wasted money. Seinfeld put big red X's on the calendar because he didn't want to leave a day blank. Ramit Sethi put his gym clothes beside his bed. So, want to stop eating chips? Hide them in your apartment. Make it easier to not eat chips when you get a craving and are watching TV. Then you won't. And then you'll think you're able to avoid them. Then you'll want to avoid them. Pulling do to the front and pushing can do and want to do into the distance where they don't matter means you'll get more done. Chapter 6. What does the greatest physicist of all time say? First off, who was the greatest physicist of all time? I say Isaac Newton. My opinion, up there with Einstein. Why? Well, he discovered gravity, invented calculus, and built the telescope. Not bad. And did he believe in the do circle? Absolutely. Newton explained it best in his first law of physics. He said, an object in motion will remain in motion unless acted on by a larger force. Put it another way, start doing something, you'll continue. Why? Because motivation doesn't cause action. Action causes motivation. Chapter 7. The advertising slogan everyone knows because it follows the secret. Nike said it best, just do it. They began using that slogan in 1988, and it helped drive market share from 18% to 43%. And sales from $877 million to $9.2 billion. Nike struck a nerve we all have deep down inside. Just do it. Want to feel more confident presenting at work? Don't take public speaking lessons. Don't practice in the mirror. Just do it. Speak at the next team meeting. Just speak. Say one sentence, then realize you can speak. Then realize you want to speak. Because you know what will happen if you don't? You'll never speak. You'll place speaking in team meetings way down your rickety rails of confidence and desire. You'll take jobs without speaking opportunities. You'll never sign up to present. You'll dissolve into a corporate wallflower. Don't do that. Just do it. Chapter 8. The single greatest lesson we can learn from Home Alone. One of my favorite movies as a kid was Home Alone. We watched it on TV every Christmas. If you haven't seen it, Kevin gets stranded in his mansion when his family flies to Paris for the Christmas holidays, and he's left to discover himself, fight off burglars, and make friends with the scary old man next door. There's a great scene near the end of the movie when Kevin is talking to that old man. The old man confides that he's fallen out of touch with his son. They're not speaking. He thinks about him every Christmas, but can't pick up the phone. Why not? Why can't he do it? Confidence and motivation. He doesn't think he can do it, and as a result, he doesn't want to do it. I mention this story because in that scene, Kevin does a great job explaining what the potential downside is when we confront our fears head-on by just doing them. Here's a little snippet from the movie script. Kevin, I've always been afraid of our basement. It's dark, there's weird stuff down there, and it smells funny, that sort of thing. It's bothered me for years. Old man, basements are like that. Kevin, then I made myself go down there to do some laundry, and I found out it's not so bad. All this time I've been worrying about it, but if you turn on the lights, it's no big deal. Old man, what's your point? Kevin, my point is you should call your son. Old man, what if he won't talk to me? Kevin, at least you'll know. Then you could stop worrying about it, and you won't have to be afraid anymore. So, what's the worst thing that happens if you speak up at the company meeting? You fail miserably. But as Kevin says, at least you know. Then you don't have to be afraid anymore, and then you can try doing it again or do something else. What are the chances of failing miserably? Very low. The greatest leaders just try, and try, and try. They try, and then they try, and then they try some more. Sure, you will fail at some things, but you'll keep moving, and more often you'll succeed. Little wins turn into confidence and desire to try again, which leads to bigger wins. You gain momentum. What did comedian Stephen Wright say about building momentum? I'm writing a book. I've got the page numbers done. In that quote, he's describing that invisible butterfly feeling of forward progress we all get in our stomachs when we suddenly just start. Remember, it's easier to act yourself into a new way of thinking than to think yourself into a new way of acting. Now go forward. Just do it. Secret number 8. The simple way to master your most important relationship. Chapter 1. I run a burlesque dancing troupe. I draw muscles in medical textbooks. I sell an aspirational online existence. I stared at the girl with neon pink hair, sitting across the picnic table at the downtown hostel bar, smiled and raised my eyebrows, and took a sip of beer. I was 29 years old and sitting at a picnic table, a year after a divorce, a year of living alone, a year of therapy, and finally deciding to try online dating. I posted a profile I hoped was authentic. Quirks, weirdness, warts and all. I spent so long thinking about who I was and what I needed that I'd whittled it down to 5 words. Curious, creative, romantic, optimistic, and ambitious. I hoped that would all add up to fun and interesting and weird. As John Lennon said, it's weird not to be weird. I wrote about my love of peeling a clementine into one big snaking peel, the dusty warm air before a thunderstorm, and putting one macaroni noodle on each spoke of a fork while eating it. I wrote about how I always peek behind the shower curtain when I'm brushing my teeth to make sure nobody's hiding there, about how I arrange my books in the Dewey Decimal System, about my inability to even use a hammer, walk up 2 flights of stairs without losing my breath, or properly tie my shoelaces. Quirks, weirdness, warts and all. Flash forward a few days, and I was suddenly meeting characters from across the city. Interesting people, out of the woodwork. Where were they all my life? I had coffee with the director of a ballet, went jogging with someone who'd founded a food co-op, and met up with a marketing exec at a coffee shop lecture about life in the year 3000. I was having a blast and finally falling in love with myself. So what's the simple way to master your most important relationship? Be you. Be you. Be you and be cool with it. There is nobody else you can be better. There is so much of you unique to the world. The deep down version of you is the best version of all. You are unique and complicated. You are different and dimensional. Those rare thoughts, those flying thoughts, those late night thoughts, grab onto those and hold them. Those things you think, those things you do, those things you say, those are what slowly help define who you are to yourself. Nobody knows every thought in your head, but you do. You hear your thoughts. You should follow them. Be you. For you. Do you know why it's critical to display your true self at work and school and home? Because there is nothing more satisfying than being loved for who you are, and nothing more painful than being loved for who you're not, but pretending to be. Chapter 2. This is the most authentic person of all time. I want to take you all the way back to a peanut farm in Georgia in 1932, where a little baby boy named Roosevelt Greer was born. Friends called him Rosie, and he grew up and grew into a 6'5", 300-pound defensive tackle and NFL Pro Bowler. Rosie was a massive guy you did not want to go up against on the football field. He was part of the fearsome foursome on the LA Rams, one of the best defensive lines in history. I love Rosie Greer, but I don't love him for his football career. It's not the sacks, interceptions, or Pro Bowls that are most important. I love Rosie Greer because he was a deeply authentic person. After retiring from the NFL, Rosie let his heart lead him, and look where it led. He became a bodyguard and ended up subduing the gunman during the Robert Kennedy assassination. He became a recording artist, and his song reached number 128 on the charts. He became a talk show host in LA. And my favorite of all? Rosie Greer took up needlepoint with complete passion. He said it calmed him down, took away his fear of flying, and helped him meet women. In fact, Rosie loved needlepoint so much, he actually put out a book called Rosie Greer's Needlepoint for Men, published in 1973 and still for sale today. Rosie Greer's Needlepoint for Men is trumpeted online with 5-star reviews. Rosie let his heart lead him, and look where it led. Now imagine for a minute you were a hulking NFL football player. People staring when you walked into a restaurant, extra, extra, extra large shirts, extra, extra, extra large jeans. Picture the framed jerseys. Picture the shiny trophies. Now imagine after you retired, you, a massive NFL football player, went out and published a book about needlepoint, featuring you needlepointing your own face on the cover. What would the reactions be? What would the New York Times book review say? What would your football friends joke about? What questions would you get? Think about all of that for a second. Now think how you'd feel if you read this review of your book online. This review I'm about to read is rated the most helpful review of Rosie's book on Amazon.com. Here's what it says. 5 stars. Lovely book. I bought this for my young neighbor friend that loves the challenge of needlepoint and knitting. At 11 years old, he wants to feel that needlepoint for a young boy is not strange. Needlepoint for Men was the perfect gift. His brother is into football, and Rosie Greer's book about needlepoint brings both of those two interests together. It makes both the 7 and 11-year-old know that it is still manly to want to know and create fine art. Chapter 3. Happiness is when what you think, what you say, and what you do are in harmony. That's the power of being you. That's the feeling you get following your heart. It's not always comfortable at the beginning, but it's always comfortable at the end. Marilyn Monroe said, "Imperfection is beauty, madness is genius, and it's better to be absolutely ridiculous than absolutely boring." Mother Teresa said, "Honesty and transparency make you vulnerable." Be honest and transparent anyway. The Mad Hatter in Alice's Adventures in Wonderland asked, "Have I gone mad?" To which Alice responded, "I'm afraid so. You're entirely bonkers. But let me tell you a secret. All the best people usually are. Be you. Be you and be cool with it. Love your ticks and nicks and loves and scratches and fears and passions. Knowing them leads to living them, and living them leads to loving them. Your relationship with yourself is the most important relationship in your life. Settling into your true, weird, authentic self isn't easy, but it's the most satisfying way to have everything. Let's talk about why. So many burned-out C-level execs and financial wonders and professional speakers who I've spoken to are exhausted coming to work every day, pretending to be someone they're not. They think, the pay is so good it's worth taking the role and acting the part. But any misalignment between what you're doing and what you want to do allows a dull and invisible unhappiness to fester. Confusion sets into the heart and mind about values. That brain jam, also called cognitive dissonance, isn't just exhausting, it's dangerous. Why? Because your unique sense of self is at risk of being drowned. Your unique sense of self that was formed by long summer days and starry twilight dreams and tent conversations and first jobs with great teams, it's at risk of being buried under sandy, windswept flares of cultural expectations. You risk forgetting who you are. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "To be yourself in a world that is constantly trying to make you something else is the greatest accomplishment." But it's not easy. So why should you aim for it? Take it from Gandhi. He knew a lot about happiness. He espoused wanting nothing, doing anything, and having everything for himself and his country. He said, "Happiness is when what you think, what you say, and what you do are in harmony." That's the destination with authenticity. Total alignment of thoughts, words, and actions. Your arms and legs and brain all snapping together with a loud plastic click, like the cover on the remote control. Snap! Being you leads to happiness. Now, how do we get there? Chapter 4. Three simple tests to uncovering this secret inside you. So, let's say you're confident. Not always, but often. You're not always there, but you've gotten there before and you can get there again. Now you want to listen to yourself a bit. You want to find your authentic passion. You want to be authentic. How do you search your heart and mind to find your authentic self? Well, after sifting through Harvard visioning exercises and attending endless executive corporate retreats and paging through dusty leadership textbooks, I have found what I consider the three best tests to finding and aligning your authentic self. I have shared these tests with countless leaders, and I use them on myself at least once every year. Here they are. Number 1. The Saturday morning test. What do you do on a Saturday morning when you have nothing to do? Your authentic self should go toward that. 2. The bench test. How do you feel when you put yourself in a new situation? Your authentic self will lead you toward that. And 3. The 5 people test. Who are the 5 people closest to you in the things you love most? Your authentic self is an average of those people. Now let's talk about each of the 3 tests in detail. Number 1. The Saturday morning test. Let's start with a horrible question. What do you want to do when you grow up? I worry about that question because it sits invisibly over much of our lives. Professional designations, business cards, resumes with job titles and bullet points. These are great things, but the downside to this filtering and organizing is that so many people grow up stuffing their textured, layered, complex selves into narrow buckets that don't allow room for individuality. Nobody knows what they want to do with their entire life. Nobody. Nobody is born with a single unifying sense of purpose that they strive toward forever. Have people at your work ever said, "I just backed into this job," or, "I never said I wanted to do this when I was younger. I didn't even know it existed." My point is, it just doesn't happen. Having one giant purpose that you strive toward forever isn't the goal. What is? An ikigai. A current aim. A reason to get out of bed in the morning.
The Saturday morning test helps find an authentic passion and check if you're letting that passion be as big a part of your life as it could be. The Saturday morning test is your answer to one simple question. What do you do on Saturday morning when you have nothing to do? Ask yourself that one crucial question, think about it for a second, and answer it out loud. What do you do on Saturday morning when you have nothing to do? Do you go to the gym? Do you record yourself playing guitar? Take whatever answer you have and then wildly brainstorm ways you can pursue opportunities that naturally spew from that passion. There will be hundreds. Love going to the gym? Personal training, coaching a baseball team, volunteering for a walking group, running a yoga studio, teaching phys ed, starting a supplements company, and it goes on. Love recording yourself playing guitar? How about teaching guitar online, editing music, learning to DJ, starting up an instrument company? One of the happiest people I've ever met was a high school music teacher who decided to start importing, selling, and teaching the ukulele. Your true self will be drawn to these ideas. They make you richer, stronger, and happier in your work life too. Dale Carnegie said, "Are you bored with life? Then throw yourself into some work you believe in with all your heart. Live for it, die for it, and you will find happiness that you had thought could never be yours." The Saturday morning test asks you to lean in to your natural passion to enrich your work and personal lives. And now it's time for the second test. I call this one the bench test. I met Fred Tate in July 1998 in the SHAD program. Vancouver was our home during this month-long summer camp for teenage nerds as we bounced between astrophysics lectures, particle accelerator field trips, and long conversations on the Oceanside campus of the University of British Columbia. Geniuses are hard to spot, but Fred was a certified genius in my book. Crisp thoughts, sharp observations, a piercingly insightful view of the world. I knew he was going far, but I was 18, he was 17, and our masking tape stuck friendship got tossed on the shelf when we went to different colleges and got immersed in our own lives. Years later, I Googled him and saw he worked as an investment banker in New York City. I cold called the place and politely asked for Frederick Tate, please. When he answered his desk line, I said, "Hey Fred, it's Neil Pasricha," and it was a mini telephone reunion. I planned a trip down to New York to hang out with him for a weekend. I spent 4 years at Queens, he spent 4 years at Princeton, and we were eager to hear about each other's experiences. We spent an hour searching for the blue whale in the Museum of Natural History as we caught up. "So how'd you pick Princeton anyway?" I started. "I mean, I knew you were smart and all, but why not Harvard, or Yale, or Cornell, or Columbia?" "Well, I was lucky I had some options," he humbly mumbled. "I didn't know where to go, so I made a test to figure it out. I called it the bench test. Basically, I figured I could rent a Jeep for a week for $200, and I knew making this decision was worth more than $200. So I rented a Jeep, and I visited Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Brown, Dartmouth, and Columbia. At each campus, I walked around until I found a bench near the middle of campus. Then I sat in the bench for an hour and just listened. I watched the students and listened to all the conversations around me. I listened to what was important to them, how they talked to each other, and what they were excited about. "How did you decide to do that?" I asked. "Well," Fred continued, "I figured most of my time over the next 4 years would be spent doing exactly what I was listening to. Going to classes was 20 or 30 hours a week, tops. The rest is making friends, chatting on the way to class, figuring out plans. Basically, my experience was going to be the sum of all the conversations I had over 4 years. So I tried to hear those conversations and figure out if they were a good fit for me. I tried listening to my authentic self and letting it lead me toward the right decision." I was impressed. I knew hundreds of people who went to university. I knew the majority spent time paging through websites, going on campus tours, and visiting the library stacks, researching for hours the pros and cons from the books. That's what I did. But the bench test was so much simpler than all that. Fred didn't ask anybody where he should go to school because he knew their opinions were based on their experiences, not his.
He didn't bother with campus tours highlighting famous statues and state-of-the-art treadmills. He didn't sift through campus demographics and SAT score sheets and university guidebooks. He didn't care. He just went to campus and sat on a bench. The bench test worked for Fred because he immersed himself in the new situation he wanted to test and then patiently observed his authentic reaction to that situation. Let me say that again. The bench test worked because he immersed himself in the new situation he wanted to test and then patiently observed his authentic reaction to that situation. That's what the bench test is about. Really putting yourself into something new for a short time just to test it. Can you use the bench test in other places? Absolutely. Just call it the office tour test during your job interview, the sidewalk test when you're looking for a new home, the treadmill and shower test when you're looking for a gym. Think about going for an interview at a new company. You're desperate to learn about the company culture and workplace. Should you ask, "What's the culture like?" No, I get asked that so often in interviews. But that's like reading about school in a textbook or learning how to drive a car in a classroom. You need to get into the office. You need to feel the culture. How? The office tour test. Ask for a 5-minute walk around the place after your interview is over. You may not be able to sit on a bench, but you'll see everything you need to know. I'll never forget my first tour of the Walmart home office during my job interview. Sitting on cheap, wobbly garage sale chairs in the humming front reception, I watched a motley crew of smiling 50-somethings, flashy 30-year-olds, and baby-faced college grads quickly walking in and out of the place. It was like an animated office diversity poster. Nobody was dressed up, people were all ages, nobody was using big words. The walls were full, too. I walked past the company mission in block letters. We save people money so they can live better. I liked that they knew what they were doing and talked about doing it. There was a flowchart of the company's history, rankings of the top 5 and bottom 5 vendors, and a cutout sign with today's share price listed and the sentence, "Tomorrow depends on you." I walked around with my interviewer, Antoinette, as she led me down a long hallway and up a flight of stairs. On the way, she said hi to every single person by name, and they said hi to her by name, too. I felt like we were on a red carpet. I asked her, "With 1,000 people working here, how do you know everyone?" "Easy," she replied. "We have the 10-foot rule. You say hi to everybody within 10 feet of you. It's based on asking customers how you can help in store. Our name badges have our names printed in big letters, and we hang them on our shirt collars so they're easy to read. It's like those 'Hello, my name is' stickers at parties, except we wear them all the time." The culture definitely wasn't for everybody, but I loved it immediately. The bench test is immersing yourself in a new situation and observing your reaction to make sure your decision is aligned with your authentic self. And the final test is called the 5 people test. The company is the 5 people you sit beside. My leadership professor at Harvard said this all the time. What did he mean? The 5 people on your team, the 5 people you eat lunch with every day, the 5 people telling you all about the company. They are the company. They create and help articulate your view of the company. "Are your friends making you fat?" asked the New York Times, with an article and research studies concluding that even our weight may be based on the weight of our friends. Hang out with fat people, you become fat. What if they hang out with fat people? They become fat, then you become fat. Sad but true. Some studies have even suggested you're the average of your friends' height and their attractiveness. Makes sense when you see old married couples that look the same, or people who look like their dogs. Researchers Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler write in their best-selling book, Connected, "We discover that if your friend's friend's friend gained weight, you gained weight. We discover that if your friend's friend's friend stopped smoking, you stopped smoking. And we discover that if your friend's friend's friend became happy, you became happy." Best-selling author James Altucher took the idea even further in the main points of his The Power of 5 article. He writes, "You are the average of the 5 people around you. You are the average of the 5 things that inspire you most. My thoughts are the average of the 5 things I think about. My body and mind are the average of the 5 things I eat. I am the average of the 5 things I do to help people each day." Remember this. You are the average of the 5 people around you. You're the average of their intelligence. You're the average of their looks. You're the average of their positivity. You're the average of their creativity. You're the average of their ambition. So what's the five people test? Take a look at the five people closest to you, and remember, you're the average of them. There's you in the middle. Want to know how positive you are? Average the attitude of the five people you spend time with most. Want to know how strong a leader you are? Average the leadership qualities of your five closest peers. Want to know how confident you are? Average the confidence of the five people you hang out with most. Sure, it's an approximation, but the five people test shows us who we are, to ourselves. It's one of the three tests you can use to find your authentic self. As the American philosopher William James said, wherever you are, it is your own friends who make your world. Chapter 5. The Five Greatest Regrets of the Dying and How to Avoid Them. Bronnie Ware is an Australian palliative nurse who spent years taking care of the dying in the last 3 months of their lives. When questioned about any regrets they had or anything they would do differently, she says, common themes surfaced again and again. She eventually put together the five most common regrets from people moments away from their last breath and posted it online. It went viral, and the story was picked up by The Guardian and The Daily Mail, amongst others. So what were the greatest regrets she heard from patient after patient? Didn't make enough money? Didn't work enough hours? Not enough vacations? Not enough homes? No. You know that by now. The five greatest regrets of the dying are... 1. I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. 2. I wish I hadn't worked so hard. 3. I wish I had the courage to express my feelings. 4. I wish I had stayed in touch with my friends. And 5. I wish I had let myself be happier. Every time I read this list, I am stunned into silence for a minute. I think how many of these regrets I would have if I died today. There are always a couple I can work on, and this list serves as an inspiration. But one thing I also notice is this entire list relates to authenticity. Directly. It's all about being you. What happens if you be you and be cool with it? Well, I would argue if you're being yourself, then you do live a life true to yourself. You do overvalue your time and find a job that fits your life. You do express your feelings. You do keep in touch with your friends. And you do let yourself be happier. Being you removes regrets from your life. Authenticity removes regrets from your life. Here are a few additional observations from Nurse Bronnie that were shared in The Guardian. Notice how they all relate to authenticity. She says, I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. This was the most common regret of all. When people realize that their life is almost over and look back clearly on it, it is easy to see how many dreams have gone unfulfilled. Most people had not honored even a half of their dreams and had to die knowing that it was due to choices they had made or not made. She continued, many people suppress their feelings in order to keep peace with others. As a result, they settled for a mediocre existence and never became who they truly were capable of becoming. Many developed illnesses relating to the bitterness and resentment they carried as a result. I wish that I had let myself be happier. This is a surprisingly common one. Many did not realize until the end that happiness is a choice. They had stayed stuck in old patterns and habits. The so-called comfort of familiarity overflowed into their emotions as well as their physical lives. Fear of change had them pretending to others and to themselves that they were content, when deep within, they longed to laugh properly and have silliness in their life again. Chapter 6. When there are no enemies within, the enemies outside cannot hurt you. There is nothing as gratifying as living a life where you are you, because you can't be who you're not. The Bhagavad Gita, the sacred Hindu text, says it's better to live your own destiny imperfectly than to live an imitation of somebody else's life with perfection. Pretending to be better you instead of normal you
means spending energy focusing on this person and then acting them into existence. How exhausting. If you were a computer, this would be spending brain power to flash a beautiful screensaver at everyone walking by. It takes time and